Having changed the topic of the lecture, there are two reasons for it. One reason was that I got the impression that I should balance the Trinitarian theology, which I presented to you last night, with a piece of political theology, so that the balance of which I spoke in the convocation lecture comes through and can be seen. And second, I thought that the best preparation for watching the Jimmy Carter-Gerald Ford debate and your election would be a piece of political theology, especially of human rights, because more and more I believe that human rights can be taken as a guideline for politics and especially for elections. So this little piece of study on human rights, which I would like to present to you tonight, comes out of a worldwide study of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. 6 years ago in Nairobi, we decided to make a worldwide study on human rights, and we got a lot of response from all over the world. Many contributions came in anonymously for good reasons, and there were a lot of doubts about this theology of human rights and whether or not theology should be involved with human rights. Finally, I wrote a summary on my own responsibility, and that's it, what you will hear tonight. Now, first of all, the Declaration of Human Rights, considered valid today in the United Nations, are to be found in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948 and in the International Covenants on Human Rights of 1966. These international covenants on human rights include the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Optional Protocol on the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Unfortunately, these covenants have not been ratified by all member states. I believe there is still a debate in the Senate of your country on whether or not this should be ratified. We have to be aware of the fact, however, that on the basis of their various political, economic, and social histories, the nations emphasize and seek to realize different aspects of human rights. For example, under the influence of the misery caused by fascist dictatorships, the North Atlantic states have formulated the individual human rights over against the state and the society. These formulation of individual human rights have a long history, beginning with the habeas corpus rights and the freedom of religion and the freedom of conscience and the freedom of speech, etc., etc. Normally, we in the West call these individual human rights the human rights, but that is not true. In their struggle against capitalism and class rule, the socialist states have given preeminence to what they call social human rights. And these are also human rights. And finally, the nations of the Third World are demanding the right to economic, social, and political self-determination. Human rights, therefore, cannot be viewed as abstract ideals, but must be looked at against the background of the real suffering and the present struggle of individuals, nations, and states. Now, the task of Christian theology is not that of trying to present once more what thousands of experts, lawyers, legislators, and diplomats in the United Nations have already accomplished. Some theologians try that, but I think they should abstain from that. But neither can Christian theology allow itself to dispense with the discussion of and the struggle for the realization of human rights. Why not? On the grounds of the creation of men and women in the image of God. On the ground of the incarnation of God for the reconciliation of the world. and on the ground of the coming of the kingdom of God as a consummation of history. The concern that is entrusted to Christian theology is one for the humanity of persons as well as for their ongoing rights and duties. The specific task of Christian theology in these matters is grounded, for my impression, is grounding fundamental human rights on God's right to, or God's claim upon human beings, their dignity, their fellowship, their rule over the earth and their future. Here lies, I believe, the special task of Christian theology to make clear God's right to or God's claim upon human beings, that they are his image on earth. Herein lies the dignity of human beings. It is a duty of the Christian faith, beyond human rights and duties, to stand for this dignity of human beings in their life with God and for God. The Church, Christian congregations, ecumenical organizations have the clear task and duty of identifying, promoting, and realizing human rights, since they are neither private associations nor statutory authorities, yet must exist and must work in the public eye. Those Christian organizations can be expected, and this is an expectation many diplomats are uttering, can be expected to be less influenced by their self-interests and to be better able to enter the struggle for human rights with less prejudice than other institutions. This is why one can expect from them self-criticism as well as a criticism of the egoism of the nations, states, classes, and races in which they, the Christians and their churches, find themselves. Hence, one can also expect their witness to a human solidarity with all those who bear the human countenance, and more particularly, their willingness to stand up for those robbed of their fundamental rights and freedoms. Now, first of all, I would like to try a small theology of right to explain what God's claim upon human beings is. Christian theology on the strength of biblical witnesses is related to God's dealing with people in history. What is at issue here is the liberation and redemption of human beings from their sinful godlessness and their deadly inhumanity, and thus also the realization of their original destiny through having been created in the image of God. Now, according to the Old Testament, Christian theology reflects the liberation of Israel from slavery in Egypt, the covenant of the liberating God with a liberated community, and the rights and duties of the people of God, which are implied in the covenant of freedom. Now, liberation, covenant, and the claim of God are the basic content of the biblical witness of the Old Testament, and indeed they are found in this order. They have decisive directional power for Israel and for Christianity in particular, and I believe also a kind of exemplary significance for all human beings and nations. The human rights to freedom, to community, to dominion, and to the future are inseparable constituents of God's claim upon human beings and the whole creation. They make up the inalienable dignity of human beings living in a covenant relation with God. Now, according to the New Testament, Christian theology reflects the liberation of human beings from sin, law, and death, to follow theology of Paul, through the coming, the sacrifice, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In the lordship of the crucified Son of Man, the vicious circle of evil, which must bear ever greater evil, is broken through, and the freedom of the children of God begins to appear. Liberation through the vicarious death of Christ, the new covenant in his blood, and the new rights and duties of the fellowship, which is composed of slaves and freemen, Jews and Gentiles, men and women, are the basic content of the biblical witness of the New Testament. Because in his coming, his sacrifice, and his resurrection, Christ is, as it is said in the New Testament, the visible image of the invisible God, human beings in his fellowship become his brothers and sisters and set out on the way towards the realization of their human destiny as the image of God in the world. Herein lie his grace and their dignity. Now, by reflecting the liberation, the covenant, and the claim of God according to the biblical witness, Christian theology also discovers the freedom, the covenant, and the right of human beings today, and therefore brings out the pain caused by their present inward and outward enslavements, as well as the struggle for their liberation from these enslavements toward a life of dignity, rights, and duties, and the fellowship with God. In a world which is not yet the kingdom of God, Christians cannot leave any area of life without the witness of the divine liberation, the covenant of God, and the dignity of human beings within this covenant. The biblical witness to liberation, covenant, and God's claim lead to a corresponding Christian practice and theology today. But the question is this not true only for Christians? What has this to do with human rights of every human person? Now, the universal presupposition of the particular history of God's dealing with Israel and with Christianity is found in the reality that the God who liberates and redeems them is the creator of all human beings and things. This is a part of the God experience of Israel in the Old Testament, of Christianity in the New Testament. It's not just their God, but it is the God, the creator of all human beings and things. Therefore, and this is to some extent unique in the history of religions, the first human being in the Old Testament is not the first Jew, but Adam, the first human being. Thus, in God's liberating and redeeming action, the original destiny of human beings is both experienced and fulfilled. In the image of God concept, the divine claim upon human beings is as expressed. Human rights to life, freedom, community, and self-determination mirror God's claim upon persons because in their relationships and life, they are destined to reflect the image of God. And the same is true if we look at the universal purpose, the universal future of the particular existence of Israel and of Christianity. The universal purpose of Israel's and Christianity's particular experience of God is found in the reality that the God who liberates and redeems them is experienced as a fulfiller of the history of the world, who will bring his claim upon his creation to realization in his kingdom. Thus, his liberating and redeeming action in history reveals the true future of human beings. The image of God is their real future in God's kingdom. Now, in all their relationships in life, they therefore have a right to future. Human rights mirror the claim of the coming God and of his future upon human beings. Now, God's claim upon human beings was and is experienced only in concrete events of liberation of human beings in their specific covenant with God in his rights of and duties inherent in their freedom. The image of God as destiny points to God's indivisible claim upon human beings and therefore to their inalienable dignity. Now, in this next part, I would like to develop some fundamental human rights, to some extent to affirm what is declared in the General Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenants, and to some extent to go beyond that. By fundamental human rights, we mean those rights and duties which belong essentially to what it means to be truly human, because without their being fully acknowledged and exercised, human beings cannot fulfill their original destiny of having been created in the image of God. Now, first, image of God is human beings in all their relationships in life. The image of God is not only the soul or the peak of the soul, but the full existence of human beings. Some Old Testament scholars say to walk upright, that is the image of God. Therein can be seen the image of God on earth. Anyway, it is not just a part of man, a divine sparkle in the human existence, which is called the image of God, but the full life, the full existence, soul and body, the individual and the community. Human beings in the fullness of their life and in all life's relationships, economic, social, political, and personal, are destined to live, as it is said in the Old Testament again and again, before the face of God, to respond to the word of God and responsibly to carry out their task in the world, implied in their being created in the image of God. So they are persons before God, and as such capable of acting on God's behalf and responsible to him. As a consequence of this, a person's rights and duties as a human being are inalienable and indivisible, as your beautiful constitution says. Economy, society, and the state and the church have to respect this dignity and responsibility of human beings, for their role as human beings with rights and duties comes before any constituting of society and government. Respect for the freedom of conscience is the foundation of a free society. I think one should be reminded of this again and again, because it is often forgotten. Often in monarchical folklore and in political ideologies, since very early times, the king alone is called the image of God, the Babylonian mirror of the princes, for example, older than Genesis 1 or 2, says, the shadow of God is a prince, and the shadow of the prince is a people. So only the prince is the image of God. Only the ruler has a function as a mediator between the gods and the people. And this occurred again in the theological writings in favor of absolutism in the 17th and 18th century. The king alone, especially the one in Versailles, is the visible image of God on earth, and the people and the other persons are only in so far as a shadow from this sun king falls upon them, also images of God. Now, when the Bible calls human beings the image of God, this, I believe, constitutes a fundamental criticism of the divinization of the rulers and their ideologies of rule. Not the king, and not the king alone, but individual human beings are the mediator between God and the people. And it follows that human beings do not exist for the sake of rule, rule rather exists for the sake of human beings. At least in this way worked as a criticism over against absolutism again and again, the memory of Genesis 1:26, that the human beings, men and women, every and each person is image of God on earth and not only one king. From this follows whether this is already was already the intention of the priestly writer or not. From this follows in the history of interpretation the democratization in principle of every kind of rule by human beings over others. The rulers and the ruled must be recognizable in like manner and in common as being human. This is possible only when there is an equality under the law for all citizens, and not a special law for the king or the president. A constitution, or as it is, was first said in this country, the covenant, must guarantee the fundamental human rights as basic rights of the citizens, must bind together those who are ruling and those who are ruled. Only on the basis of equality under the law can expression be given to the common human identity of rulers and ruled alike. The human rights and duties implied in the image of God concept are honored in history through the constant, open, and incessant process of democratization, of democratizing the shaping of the people's political will. This is the historically developed form in which, in politics, we honor the image of God in every person. The control of the exercise of rule through the separation of powers, the limitation of the mandate to rule to a stipulated period of time, and the extensive self-rule and direct participation of the people are the historically developed means for honoring the image of God present in human beings. It's so much discussed discussion about socialism between Christians and whether Christians should be for socialism or not. I think in our countries we should start with Christians for democracy and then go on with democratizing the economy, and that can then be called socialism, I believe. But we cannot work for socialism on the costs of democracy, because democracy is just try to explain, is the historically developed way of honoring the image of God in every person. Now, if human rights are based on God's claim upon human beings, and if human freedoms are rooted in the liberation by God, then we also have to formulate the fundamental human duties, without which those rights and freedoms cannot exist. It's to some extent a lack in the General Declaration of Human Rights that only the rights are formulated and not the duties. Freedom and rights by themselves mean virtually nothing. Just as it is crucial to formulate the dignity and the rights of human persons over against the state in order to limit and to control power and to cooperate in its exercise, so it is equally important, I believe, to heed the duties which correspond to these rights and which human beings must exercise for the sake of others. There are no rights without duties. Among these duties, we should mention here the right to resistance and the duty to resistance against illegal, illegitimate and inhuman regimes in favor of the rights of the oppressed. I believe it's not so much a question of violence or non-violence, the old question never discussed again without result. It is, we should put the question violence, non-violence in the framework or the situation of the right of resistance. And then we can talk about the possibilities of active resistance, passive resistance, silence, and martyrdom. I believe there's a certain guideline if you follow this line. If a government acts illegal against its own positive laws permanently, then the right of resistance is given, and the duty of resistance is also given to those who are in power and can exercise power. Second case is, if a government makes laws which are against its own constitution, then the right of resistance and the duty of resistance, I believe, is given to those who are in power, who have power, and can exercise power. And finally, if a government makes a constitution against the General Declaration of Human Rights, then the next case is given for the right and the duty of resistance. According to the Reformed confessional writings, one is required to obey the authorities, as Zwingli said in the Zurich Disputation, 1523, summary articles number 38, insofar as they do not command that which is contrary to God. Therefore, article 39, therefore all their laws shall be in harmony with the divine will. But, and now comes article 42, but if they are unfaithful and transgress the laws of Christ, they may be disposed in the name of God. This was the first reformed formulation of the right of resistance. And as consequence to the divine covenant of freedom, human beings are called to save the lives of the innocents, to repress tyranny, to defend the oppressed, as the Scottish Confession of 1560, Article 14 says, right of resistance to defend the oppressed, to save the life of innocents, to repress tyranny, is inside of the commandment to love your neighbor. Now, the rights which secure the freedom of persons can only be observed, I believe, if they are bound up with corresponding duties of liberating those from whom these rights are withheld. Christian love honors the right of the neighbor. Now, a second point is, image of God is human beings together with others. Only in human fellowship with other people is a human person truly image of God. The history of freedom in Europe and North America was one-sided, I believe, in emphasizing the individual rights of the human persons over against economic, social, and political organizations of rule. It is the error of liberalism to overlook the social side of freedom. Freedom is more than free enterprise. And it is a failure of individualism to overlook the social consciousness that must correspond to the human personality. It is not against his or her fellow human beings, nor apart from them, but only in human fellowship with them and for them, that the individual can correspond to his or her destiny as created in the image of God. In fellowship before God and in covenant with others, the human being is capable of acting for God, being fully responsible to him. As a consequence of this, the social rights and duties of the human community are just as inalienable and indivisible as persons' individual rights and duties. Human beings have to heed the dignity and the responsibility of community in economy, society, and state, just as the latter has to heed those of the former. It does not follow, as some have the impression, from the democratization of the rule of human beings over others, that now every human being is his or her own absolute ruler isolated as a monad. Just as according to Genesis 1:27, the image of God appears in the fellowship of men and women, male and female, so it is also represented in larger social contexts only through human fellowship. Thus, the rights of human persons to life, freedom, and self-determination always arise together with human communities' claim upon people. In principle, there is no priority of individual rights over social rights, just as conversely, there is no priority of social rights over individual rights. In principle, both stand in a genetic context of reciprocal conditioning, just as historically the processes of the socialization and the individualization of people mutually condition each other. But I believe this is one crucial point of politics in our societies today, to get a just balance between the individual rights and the social rights. For example, in West Germany, we have the right of free education in our constitution. Therefore, we admit everyone who is capable to the universities and require no tuition. Everybody has a right to get the education which he can get, and he will be paid either by the parents or by the government up to 35. But there's no right of labor. So the individual rights are developed, but the social rights of labor, of jobs, is underdeveloped. In East Germany, you have the contrary. You have the right of labor. Every person, every citizen has a right of labor. And so it comes that the government is regulating people, young people, into the jobs which are free already in age 14. And as the case is in the family of my wife in East Germany, one is educated as a sociologist, has a right of labor, but not the right of labor as a sociologist. So the person I have in mind is employed as a truck driver, but must be paid as a sociologist, which is not very much higher than a truck driver in this family. But anyway, there you have the social right of labor, and the government, the society, has to provide you with a job. That's a social right, and I believe we must find a balance between the individual right and the social rights at this point. Or to put it in a more simple example, coming out of the beautiful shores of California, I believe that in your country you might need a better balance between private beaches and public beaches, because otherwise you cannot go anymore to any lake or shore, because everything is private property and trespassing is forbidden. So a balance, for example, between the private transportation system and the social transportation system is a question. And we can go on with this if we see how these two rights are human rights and must be balanced in order to honor and realize the image of God in every person and in the community of persons. The rights of persons can only be developed in a just society, and a just society can only be developed on the ground of the rights of the person. The freedom of the individual can only be constituted in a free society, and a free society can only be constituted on the ground of individual freedom. So my next point is, add to this point the individual human rights and the social human rights, that this is a question for many nations whether they should accept the international covenants of 66 or not, because in these covenants are the social human rights to some extent formulated. Number three, being created in the image of God is the basis of the right of human beings to rule over the earth and of their right to community with the earth. I think both belong together. Now, in Genesis 1:26, the creation of human beings as the image of God is followed by the blessing of God and the human calling to be fruitful and rule over the non-human creation. The human rule over the earth is to correspond to the will and command of the Creator, who certainly loves his creation, does not want to have it destructed. Human beings are to till and keep the earth, as the Yahwist says, and to rejoice in it. Only where human dominion over the earth corresponds to the Creator's lordship over the world, do human beings fulfill their creation in the image of God. Plundering, exploitation, and the destruction of nature contradict their right and their dignity. Therefore, human dominion over the earth includes a sense of community with the earth. Human rule is only then made legitimate when it is exercised in cooperation and community with the environment, and leads to life-giving symbioses between the human society and the natural environment. The rights of human beings to rule over the non-human creation must therefore be balanced by their respecting the rights of the non-human creation. And this is not yet formulated at all in any Declaration of Human Rights. Now, two consequences. First, if the right to the earth is given to human beings, it follows that each and every human being has the basic economic right to a just share in life, food, work, shelter, and personal possessions. The concentration of the basic necessities of life and the means of production in the hands of a few should be seen as a distortion and perversion of the image of God in human beings. This is unworthy of human beings, and it contradicts God's claim upon them. The widespread withholding of basic economic rights, the impoverishing of whole peoples and population groups, and the worldwide starvation caused by political and economic imperialism in our divided and strife-torn world is nothing less than a desecration of the image of God in people and of God's claim upon each and every person. Without the realization of the fundamental economic rights of human beings to life, nourishment, work, and shelter, neither their individual nor their social rights can be realized. And this is the reason why many people in Asia and Africa are not interested in what we call human rights at all. Because if their children die because of starvation, they are not interested in individual or social human rights. First comes the eating, and then comes morality. So they are interested in economic human rights and the realization of the basic economic human right to live, to survive. And this must be taken into account in the debate between East and West on individual and social human rights, that there are millions and millions who have no economic human rights. And that is the basis. Now, the second consequence is, if along with the right of human beings to the earth, rights of the earth over against human beings are recognized, then basic ecological duties are also bound up with these basic economic rights. It is not possible to increase basic economic rights at will simply by responding to increased demands, because economic growth is determined by ecological limits, as we know. The human struggle for survival and world domination cannot be carried out on the expenses of nature, since in that case, ecological death would anyway prepare the way for the end of human life altogether. Economic human rights should therefore be brought into line with the basic cosmic conditions for the survival of humanity in its natural environment. These rights can no longer be realized through uncontrolled economic growth, but only through the growth of economic justice within the limits of economic growth. Economic justice in the provision and distribution of food, natural resources, and the industrial means of production will have to be directed towards the survival and common life of human beings and nations. This is the only way of attaining ecological stability in mutual survival as well as in common life alongside the non-human creation. Today, the economic and the ecological justice mutually condition each other and thus can only be realized together. I believe that the time may come that in certain areas, the society, the government, and the administrations have to make a covenant with nature in order to have the rights of the environment present and presented in the decision-making processes. Now, another point, number four, being created in the image of God is the basis of the right of human beings to their future and their responsibility for those who come after them. Human beings and all their relationships in life with each other and in community with the non-human creation have, as the image of God, a right to self-determination and responsibility for their future. Their true future lies in the fulfillment of their being destined to the glory of their fellowship with God, with other human beings, and with the whole creation. In human history, with a kingdom of glory not yet realized, human beings correspond to this dignity for which they are created through their openness for this future and through their responsibility for the present in face of this future. Now, people can only make use of their right to this future and their responsibility to the present if they attain the freedom of responsibility and the right to self-determination. Self-determination and responsibility to the present in the face of the future relate, first, to human beings and all their relationships in life, second, to human beings in community with others, third, to the human beings in community with the non-human creation. This is an important dimension in the basic individual, social, economic, and ecological human rights and duties. There are no human rights in the present without the right to self-determination and one's own responsibility in face of the future for people live personally, collectively, economically, and ecologically in time and history. It's very strange that if one speaks about human rights, one has in mind only the rights of this present generation. And there's no thought given to the balance between the present generation and the coming generations. Here is another blind spot in the Declaration of Human Rights. In accord with the future, we have to stand up for the right to a temporal future and the right to live to life of those who come after us. We will have to struggle not only for justice and the realization of human rights in the world of our own generation, but also for the support and preservation of justice in generations that will follow. There exists not only a personal egoism and a collective egoism, but also an egoism of the present generation. Thus, people should not exploit their present at the expenses of the future, just as there is no obligation to sacrifice their present to the future. but rather they will work for a just balance between the chances of life and freedom in the present and in the future generations. If our generation is to exploit all the resources in oil and copper, etc., I think this is then on the cost of the following generations. And here we should develop human rights in terms of the following of generations also. Our danger is that we exploit the present on the costs of the future, and that is that our children have to pay for our pleasure. In a time of overpopulation and of the limits of growth, this temporal perspective of human rights assumes particular significance, I believe. Now, my last point again is theological, more theological, specific Christian theological. Human rights are only effective insofar as people are truly human and act humanly. Their inhumanity becomes manifest in the violations and abuse of human rights. This is